There's a place in New York where you can walk through the actual front doors of the world's most famous recording studio, Abbey Road. Through those doors, past the Beatles, Pink Floyd, Radiohead, and countless other rock giants. Where can you find those doors? At the Hard Rock Cafe Times Square. The Abbey Road doors and thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock Cafes, Hard Rock Casinos, and Hard Rock Hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Steven's Underground Garage's Coolest Conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's time for your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. Joining me is English singer-songwriter Sam Fender. Since appearing on the scene over there in 2017, he's received all sorts of critical acclaim. His latest album is 17 Going Under and features our recent coolest song of the world, Getting Started. We'll hear a short bit of that now, followed by my interview with Sam Fender on your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage. Manfred here with you in Little Steven's Underground Garage, and it's time for chatting with our Coolest Conversations. And my guest today is English singer, songwriter, and guitarist Sam Fender. Hey, Sam, how are you?
I'm good, mate. How are you?
I'm hanging in there, man. I gotta say, the last year and a half, pretty crazy stuff. Have you and your family and friends managed to keep healthy over the course of the pandemic so far?
It's been a tough one for a lot of people, man. You know, there's a couple of people who got ill while it was on, and that was, you know, tough for a lot of my family and friends. You know, when it was, you know, you couldn't go visit people in hospital and stuff like that. That was tough. But we were generally pretty all right throughout most of it. I got COVID in November. And there was a few of us got it. The whole band actually got it. My whole band. We were all trapped in the house together. So that was quite fun.
And so it wasn't that severe for you?
I had a shielding letter. I got told to shield at the beginning because I've got a health condition which, you know, is supposed to weaken my immune system. So I was terrified when I first got it because I thought, you know, I could be ill. But I was actually all right. Yeah, man, I was totally fine. It was a flu for me, you know, it was a bad flu. But apart from that, I was all right.
Well, good. Now, we spoke a couple of years back, and as I recall, both your dad and older brother play music as well. Can you remind us about your upbringing, how music was present in your home life growing up?
So my dad when he was a young boy, like, worked on the rail yard and on the electrician's board, and was like, did that by day, but then by night he used to play in the social clubs and in his band. So he used to play all the social clubs in the 70s, and the social club sort of scene in the Northeast was like, it was a big thing, you know. It was kind of, everybody went to social clubs on the weekends. So I grew up watching him play when I was a little baby, you know. I'd be in my high chair in a club watching my dad play music when I was like two. I think that's partially why I'm deaf. and then my older brother, he's 9 years older than me, so he was he was, by the time I was kind of old enough to be into music, my brother was already really good at the drums and he played guitar and piano. And so I was, yeah, I was very lucky to be sort of surrounded by them two and all of the musicians that were friends with my dad and stuff. You know, people would be in and out the house. Mm-hmm. There would be work. They all had different trades. So one, there was like Stan, the gas man, and there was like Frank would do, there was like, they all had different trades. So there'd be people coming in, there'd be like plumbers and all this, and everyone was working on each other's houses all the time. They'd always like pull in favors. So I was always surrounded by like these guys who were like doing work on the kitchen or something. And then they would like load the van up with loads of amps and guitars and then go out and be in a band as well. So it was like, it was a funny, it was a great sort of camaraderie amongst all of them that like I grew up around. And I think when I was a kid, I just really wanted to be them, you know, I wanted to be like them. So, it was a good start.
So that was your initiation into the brotherhood.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I the first ever time I think I got up was with my brother's band, and it was like, you know, just playing pentatonic blues guitar over whatever song they were playing, you know?
And so then, your father and your brother, multi-instrumentalists, did you start on the guitar?
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't really deviate much from the, I mean, I play piano a bit, but I was completely obsessed with my guitar by the time I was like eight. Mm-hmm. I used to play it and fall asleep. I'd fall asleep in my school's uniform. And my dad would have to like peel the guitar off us when I was asleep and then like trying to get us and put us into bed because I would just fall asleep with all of my school clothes on. And so, yeah, it was, I was totally obsessed.
Well, let's talk about our coolest song in the world this week. It's called Getting Started. It's off your second album, 17 Going Under, that came out this past October. When did you record the album?
Over the course of sort of 2 years, really. I mean, I recorded some of it last year, and then the very last touches of it at the beginning of this year. We did it everywhere. We went over to Ireland in the middle of the pandemic and stayed in a place called Grouse Lodge. It's like mm-hmm. a farm studio in the middle of West Meath, like in the middle of nowhere in Ireland. And it's like so peaceful and it's built on a ley line and it's kind of got this sort of, there's this weird sort of energy, like beautiful, like it's beautiful, you know?
Very cool. So you were socially distanced.
Okay, no.
In the midst of nowhere.
We were socially distanced until we got there, but once we all tested negative, then we were all in our little bubble, you know?
Right, that's what I mean.
And then, and it was great because it had an unlimited Guinness tap. So we just, and I was really proud of the boys because apparently we racked up the biggest bar tab that the record labels ever had to pay in like the last 15 years. So I was really proud. I was like, get in, boys. But, yeah.
Good man.
It was Guinness and whiskey for like 2 months, but it was great. You know, it was a real, and it was just such a beautiful like area to be in when you go out for a walk, you know, it was a stunning, this landscape around there in Ireland is totally stunning. So we spent a lot of time over there and it was the most wonderful experience I've ever had making a record. I've obviously only made two, but it was a magical time, you know, and we're really proud of it.
So both this album and your debut, your other album, Hypersonic Missiles, they were produced in part or wholly, I believe the most recent one, Bramwell Bronte. And so tell me something about him because is he also Tom Lewis? Is Tom Lewis and Bramwell one and the same?
Yes, they are the same, yes. So Tom, I met Tom when I was ill, like just after I was recovering from my illness.
Yeah.
I was writing songs and I needed somebody to help me record them. And my friend, my guitarist, Dean, little Dean, he used to be the tea boy in a studio. So you just make the cups of tea for people and stuff. Mm-hmm. And we got together and he was actually going to quit. He didn't want to be in the studio anymore. Tom was sick, you know, Tom was sick of recording people that he didn't want to record.
Yeah.
And then we met and then became really good friends, and I showed him my songs and hit it off. And that's how it, that's how the partnership sort of started. You know, me and him would sort of, I would make these songs together, and he would help us record them because I'm useless with computers and stuff. You know, I can't use, I can't use Pro Tools or Logic. I'm not like, I know what I want, and I understand, like, you know, how the EQs work and all of that sort of stuff, but I just don't know how, I'm just rubbish with computers. So me and him got together, and then that was that, you know. We've made two albums since then, and it's been such a wonderful experience to do it with, you know, one of my really good friends.
So getting started, our coolest song in the world this week, there's a line early on in the song that says, when you're out of luck and your mother's in need. I'm guessing that's a reference to when you were living with your mom and she was suffering herself from a disease, fibromyalgia. That's the inspiration for that one?
Yes, yeah. It was at the time my mother was, it was just me and my mom, and we lived in a flat in North Shields that, and it was, we had black mold all over the walls, and we couldn't really afford, she couldn't afford the rent. She was unemployed at the time because she was suffering from, you know, depression and fibromyalgia, and the fibromyalgia would make her depressed, and it was kind of like a catch 22 situation. And the DWP, the Department of Work and Pensions, and the council were sending her to, you know, they were taking her to court to like make her prove that she was, that she was unfit to work, which subsequently made her a lot more ill and a lot more sad, you know. And that it was a, she, you know, this is a woman who's worked as a nurse for 40 years of her life. She's not, you know, she's not some sort of benefit cheat who's gonna like, you know, try and not work. She's not, she's not work shy. She's worked all of her life as a nurse. She practically like birthed half of the kids in the town that I grew up in. I mean, she like helped delivered half of these kids, you know. And so like at the time, it was very frustrating because I was 17, 18, and I was old enough to understand what was going on in the house, but I wasn't old enough to be able to help her in any way, and I didn't, you know, and I couldn't help her financially, apart from, you know, like drips and drabs of my wage from working in a bar. So it was quite, it was very frustrating. And I never really wrote about that sort of stuff then because I just didn't really think about it because it's just your life, you know. But right. Once I came to do this second album, I did a bit of therapy. Obviously, you start talking about the past. And that that time obviously came up in the therapy. So I feel like I just kind of had the means to be able to articulate what I was feeling at that time and turned it into a song, you know.
Well, right. And in fact, there's another line in that one. Felt like I've given up so many times before, but I'm still here climbing. And that seems to be sort of a recurring theme on the album, sort of fighting against the depression, the anxiety, possibly suicidal thoughts as best as you can. So with regards to all that, you doing okay keeping the demons at bay?
Yeah, I think so. I'm getting there. I've got very, very good. I've got very, very good friends, you know. I've got a very, very good band who really, really look after me, you know. They're like my family. And it's been a long road. I think it's been a very, very tough year for everybody, this one, you know. So I think it's important to remember, like, especially for us, you know. I've got to remember how lucky I've been with my career and stuff. So I'm more worried about my friends back home, you know, like,
yeah. Well, tell me something about your bandmates for a moment. Cause we were talking about your, you know, you grew up with your dad and your brother, and you're seeing these musicians come in and sign of this sort of brotherhood that they have developed. Tell us about your own brotherhood there with your mates, the guys in the band. How many guys are there?
There's six of us. So there's Johnny Blue Hat Davis, who's my saxophonist, and he was my brother's, like my older brother's, one of my older brother's best friends when they were kids. So I always looked up to Johnny when I was a kid because he was an amazing saxophonist when he was a teenager, and I thought it was like the coolest thing ever. And then there's my drummer, Drew Michael, who's just a powerhouse. He looks like Tarzan. And then there's my bass player, French Tom, because he's half French. And he's just a solid, he's the calming energy of the band and kind of the rational one. Then there's Joe Atkinson and Dean Thompson, who are my two guitarists, and they also play other instruments. They play like mandolin and play a lot of keys and synthesizers and things like that. And those two are like, they're the people I've known the longest. So Dean was my best friend since we were like 12, you know. We've known each other since we were kids. Apart from Johnny, obviously I've known Johnny since I was a baby, but Dean was like my school friend, you know.
Right.
And you know, they're just, they are genuinely like, it's like a family, you know. They are like my brothers, you know. And I love each and every one of them.
So another track on the album, so my neighbor growing up, one of my neighbors was Mr. Wasserman, and he would talk to, you know, myself and the family, and he was always going on about they are always up to something, but he never really elaborated as to who they are. You know, it was always like, as though we're supposed to know who they are.
Yeah.
In your tune, you're describing a they, and they're pretty atrocious. So who are they?
Who do you think they are?
Well, that's, I certainly have my ideas, but I don't want to put any my words on into your.
It's exactly what you're saying when you're describing that they character that your neighbor used to speak about. It's like, it's it could be many different people, but the whole thing's kind of like the whole thing's a rant about being so completely and utterly disillusioned by all of it, all the politics, all of everything. That you just kind of give up and you don't want anything to do with it anymore. You kind of want to, it's that whole feeling of wanting to just be off grid and not involved. And that's why they could be many people, because I'm talking like about this entity who's watched Boudicca and like the Romans and like has watched loads, all of these things that have happened over history, over the course of thousands of years of history. So it is exactly that. It's what your neighbor was talking about completely.
Well, you know, in fact, it's great to line in there that you mentioned Boudicca, the warrior queen. This is back to the Roman times that she led this rebellion against the Romans. And it's great that you just mentioned her, because to most Americans, they won't have any idea. Like, what? The Romans were in England? Oh, when did that happen?
First English, she was technically like the first sort of English queen, really, wasn't she? Like the first sort of famous one.
Right. And one more thing about that song is why do they hate the poor? And there's also
that line's actually supposed to be perceived as, and I knew it wouldn't be, I knew it would be perceived the way you said it, but it's actually poor hate the poor.
Yes. Well, that was my second part of this, you know. Why is that? Why are the poor hating the poor?
Because of the politics of division and because of the way the media presents immigrants. And, you know, as these, you know, they portray refugees as people coming over to steal your job and your livelihood, then that's where the division starts. And I've grown up in a world where I've seen people who are poor just hating their neighbor purely because of where they're from or whatever, you know? And that's exactly what the established right wing want you to believe, isn't it? And they want you to be angry at that. I think that's literally all I meant by that. Like,
oh yeah. And in fact, so myself being a Southerner originally, that was all the politics of in the Deep South was to, in fact, Bob Dylan's got a great line about a poor white man being kept on a chain and taught to hate. And, you know, he could have nothing, but as long as there was someone below him that had less, then he would feel better about himself and never want to address the problems and the issues that kept him in a chain to begin with. right?
Really, yeah. I mean, that was a lot more articulate than what I just said there, but you know, but it was like, yeah, and it's not just that as well. It was kind of, I remember when I grew up, there was a load of like TV shows in England. There was this one called Benefit Street, which was kind of like, they used to kind of describe it as a like poverty porn or something. It was like, they would make these sort of sensational programs about people who were claiming benefits from the government. Mm-hmm. And how they were like, and how they were scoundrels and not doing anything and just, and stealing basically welfare. And that created this whole genuine sort of disdain and prejudice towards anybody who was on benefits. Obviously, yeah, there's a vast majority of people who are using disabled benefits or sickness pay need it, you know?
In the US, that's the myth of the welfare queen. And it's the same exact thing that's trotted out.
It's used to, you know, it's used to make working class people despise the people who are unfit to work and all of this, and tar them as you know, lazy, work shy people. But the reality is, it's like, it's nothing in compared to the money that it costs to look after these people is, you know, it pales in comparison to the amount of money not dodged and taxed by bloody Tesco's. Like the shops in there, actually, you don't even have Tesco in America, do you? So I'm trying to think about, I don't know, I'm trying to think of an equivalent shop. Yeah, well, it, over here anyway, our big supermarket, one of them is like Tesco's, you know, and they, you know, the amount of money that they don't pay in taxes, the amount of hedge funds that all of these scoundrels have, it like completely dwarfs the cost of benefits for the entire country. Yet we never seem to talk about that. We always seem to talk about these benefit cheats, and it always seems to be the people who are getting in trouble for the economy, or the people who are paying for the economy always seem to be the people with the least, you know?
Absolutely. Well, you know, we can listen to one more song today, and I want us to talk about the title track in a moment. But first, do you have any New Year's resolutions? Is that anything that you normally do? Make New Year's resolutions or not?
I never make New Year's resolutions.
Well, that's the easiest one to keep.
That's my New Year's resolution is don't make them.
You have any plans for New Year's Eve?
I'm actually going to try. I think I'm going to try and dodge all the parties.
Yeah.
Because I just, it always gets really crazy back home. Everyone goes completely nuts, you know? And I just, yeah. I'm exhausted after this year of touring and stuff. I just kind of want to get a bit of rest, you know?
Any plans to come into the US sometime next year?
Yes. We're coming next year. So we're going to put a tour on, a little tour, and then we're going to do some, come out and do some promo and come out and try and push the album and see what we can do.
And do you know yet what time of the year that'll be? In the fall or summer?
I think it'll probably be in the spring.
Oh, even better. Even better. So as I mentioned, we can only listen to...
Go ahead. It might be the summer. I think it's the summer.
We're looking forward to that. Now, I mentioned we can only listen to one more song off the album as we go out here. And I want us to take a listen to 17 Going Under, the title track. And the second verse, you've got the line that I really liked a whole lot, where you're saying, that's the thing with anger. It begs to stick around so it can fleece you of your beauty and leave you spent but not to offer. Is that something you have to deal with? Do you have a lot of frustration and anger built up?
I did, yeah. I did. I think I'd saw the way that the DWP and the council and government treat my mother when she was at her weakest, and how they preyed on her and made her incredibly iller and more sick. And as an 18-year-old, like that frustration, because she used to always say things like when she was struggling with money and stuff. She used to always talk about how she felt ashamed and how she felt embarrassed. And I was just so, I wanted to just get the bastards that made my mother feel that way. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I was like, how dare they? Somebody who's worked for the NHS, somebody who's worked for the National Health Service as a nurse for 40 years of my life, give undying service to the people of my hometown, to be treated like that by our own, you know, by your own government, which is this, it's the same sort of case for a lot of people, you know. And I don't know, I grew up like angry and sort of and also embarrassed myself, you know, because I had like, because of the stress and stuff at the time, I had sort of bad skin issues and things, and right. I turned up to school with dirty clothes and like, which was, my skin was always like manky, you know what I mean? So I used to get really like, I used to get quite sort of ashamed of it, and it erodes your self-esteem as a teenager, you know? So I did grow up with a lot of anger, and I didn't quite understand where it was coming from until I did a bit of, you know, the therapy stuff, and you kind of pick it apart, and it's like, well, of course that's going to make you feel like that, you know? But then that was channeled, obviously the line where I said, you know, that's the thing with anger, it begs to stick around so it can fleece you of your beauty, because it did, you know, that sort of internal anger did sort of cause problems for us as I was becoming a young adult, you know? Which now I feel like I've resolved and feel like I'm a lot more placid.
So 17 going under that, you know, you're drawing a lot of these experiences from around that age, you know, going into the troubles your mom was having and dealing with that. I've got to imagine that the writing through the songs, performing the songs, that's also been sort of the therapy helping you deal with all that.
Yeah, it's very cathartic.
What about, so what's for the future? Do you have an idea yet, like what the next record would be about? Do you feel like these issues are kind of resolved to a degree, and what are you looking towards next, or where are you at?
I only started doing the therapy 2 years ago, you know, and it kind of, that's what bust opened the Pandora's box for all of the song ideas that I got for 17. And I've got so many more from that time as well, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm still kind of writing about that, but I'm also turning my eye more closely to my hometown as well. And my friends, the things that my friends are facing, because all of my pals still live here and work here and all have jobs, and some of them even have families, you know?
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, There's a lot changed in the Northeast, and there's a lot changed in well, both of our countries, UK and America, and the whole world, you know, because of the pandemic.
Right.
Economically, it's it's took a big beating, you know. So it's there's a lot to write about right now, you know. So I think I'm gonna be all right with writing material. I've just got to put a pen down on the paper, you know.
I hear you. Well, man, Sam, thank you so much for talking with me on our Coolest Conversations.
Thank you very much, mate. Thank you.
We're going to take a listen now to the title track, your latest album, 17 Going Under. It's Sam Fender in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
I remember the sickness was forever. I remember snuff videos. Cold September's, the distances we covered, the fist fights on the beach, the busies round us up. Do it all again next week, an embryonic love. The first time that it's scarred, embarrass yourself for someone, crying like a child. And the boy you kicked Tom's head in still bugs me now. That's the thing, it lingers and curses you when you die. Your beauty and leave you spent when out to over.
with some of the title track to his latest album, 17 Going Under. That was Sam Fender here in Little Steven's Underground Garage. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to Sam for speaking with me on our Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza for producing our segment. And next time, join me when I speak with Kristen Pinnell Ryle. She's a lead guitarist in the Gribweeds from Highland Park, New Jersey. Their latest album, Dig, is full of way cool covers, and we'll dig into it next time on your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage. Picture of my